This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 17th of November 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated design show. I'm your host, Josh Fennett. On today's show, we'll be previewing some of the design-minded finds from the burly new issue of Monocle magazine, which hits newsstands this Thursday. First up on the show, we talk about the role of design in our cities and the future of fonts with legendary graphic designer and special guest, Lance Wyman.
If graphics can help pull things together through a visual system or a visual means of just showing that everything can work better, I mean, wow, that's like a dream job.
Next, we take time in the watch industry and learn more about a London-based fair that's ticking over nicely.
It's not just something that you wear on your wrist. It becomes a lifestyle for people. People collect watches. You know, the hand craftsmanship of so much of these things is mind-boggling.
All that to come and plenty more besides right here on Section D on Monocle 24. First up on the show, we head to New York to meet a designer whose work has defined a generation. Anyone acquainted with the world of graphic design will likely be familiar with New Jersey-born Lance Wyman. Wyman's most lauded creation was the visual identity for the 1968 Olympic Games in Mexico, as well as notable projects for the Minnesota Zoo and Washington, D.C.'s Metro Map. Wyman was one of the first designers to argue that clarity and simplicity should be the guiding principles of his medium, and has been one of the clearest voices in the debate on the importance of wayfinding in cities, decades, we might add, before it became a popular notion in city halls the world over. Lance Wyman spoke to Monocle's David Pleasant for the December-January issue of Monocle magazine, and here's just some of what he had to say.
My first sketch was being completely naive about Mexico because, I mean, at that point, we didn't learn much about Latin America, and I certainly didn't know much about Mexico. So the first step was to go over to the Museum of Anthropology and kind of absorb those early cultures. And I realized that a lot of the work that came out of those early cultures was some of the most beautiful things I've seen as far as taking simple geometry and, you know, describing things like nature, like mythology, like, I mean, even emotions. I mean, they were just terrific at it. So that was kind of step number one. And then really, as far as any kind of guidelines to work with, I remember Ramitas Vasquez saying, you know, we had to use three languages whenever we used language. We had to use Spanish, French, and English. Another big rule, of course, was using the five rings of the Olympic symbol that had existed at that point. I think Pierre Coubertin introduced that when the modern Olympics first started. So, okay, and there was one other little thing. He said, we don't want a guy with a sombrero falling asleep under a cactus with a tequila in his hand. He says, that's not the image of Mexico that we're trying to, you know, portray. And that was really it. And boy, he was right on about that, because Mexico was just starting to really come to life as a modern culture. I mean, it was really exciting to be there at that time. So that was step number one, learning about the early culture in Mexico. And then step number two was just, you know, breaking our tails as far as trying to come up with an idea for the, you know, a solution or something that could start a solution within that two-week period. And that's when I got lucky, because I guess I had the background also to go down there. I had worked with the George Nelson office, as I mentioned. I had met a student from Yale who was studying graphic design, and that was the first time I saw graphic design really as a formal teaching. And I loved it, so I've been doing it ever since, and I guess that was lucky to start off in such a big way.
Can we talk about the notion of country branding, and how do you go about doing that without falling into the trap of stereotype and so on? How do you strip things back and refine an image of a whole country, a whole culture?
First of all, there has to be an attitude of wanting to do it. I think design itself had kind of run down that universal road, and that was kind of making everything the same. It's not that. It's really making things what they are as far as representing a culture, representing a city, representing aspirations of a city. And I think that's where the look has to take place. I mean, I think that's where the research starts. And to see really what you're dealing with, and try to do it without any attitude, just really kind of look at what's there, what wants to be there as far as the people that live there, work there, what, you know, might help as far as the people visiting or make people want to visit, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I think, you know, that's kind of a basis to start from, and that's where I try to start from. But I'd say basically it's just to see what's there and not to go in with any attitude. I think that's where I'm at a better advantage, not to hit this, you know, the stereotypical stuff. And sometimes you make discoveries that are very, very helpful that way.
Looking back, it's quite interesting how that Mexico 68 campaign, your work, is really held up as something of a benchmark by graphic designers, certainly. You often hear nothing is as good as that one. What do you think has happened since? What's happened to that sort of clarity? Do you think there's something missing now?
Well, you go back even before that, before what happened after what we did in Mexico, because I think the intent in Mexico was to, you know, one, make it very clear that the Olympics were happening and what was happening. And they had the sports program, they had the cultural program, so they had a rather larger expressive canvas to work with, if you will. But the other thing that we did in Mexico was make the Olympics intentionally look like they were in Mexico. So we intentionally created a sense of place, and I think Ramírez Vázquez did that when he did international trade fairs or world fair pavilions for Mexico. You were in a contemporary environment in his pavilions, but you knew they were Mexican. And, you know, that was a kind of a want. It was a concept, if you will, that we had started right from the very beginning to try to accomplish. So that was one thing that I'm not sure. And I mean, from my own experience, I could not know how much of that entered into the planning for any of the Olympics before or after Mexico. But I think the Olympics themselves have changed. Mexico is very fortunate. It's probably maybe one of the last rather pure Olympics as far as the games being the most important thing. You know, they've become commercial. Not only have the games themselves become commercial as far as being staged, but the whole staging, I mean, now with media and everything, it's become like a Cirque du Soleil. I mean, it's not just expressing sports anymore. It's expressing a lot of other things that might not be nationalistic as far as where the games are held. You know, it depends on what the want is as far as the expression is concerned. So I think that's a big, big part of the difference between the Olympics now and the way they were back in Mexico when I had the chance to experience that.
I believe you're sort of revisiting Mexico City particularly in some current work. Maybe tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, that's in the planning stages right now. Hopefully it'll evolve into a full-blown project. But the intent, I can tell you what that is, it would be to put everything under one umbrella. You know, I mean, I remember working on projects here in New York. In fact, I can remember a very specific one down at Penn Station in New York. One of the transit lines that I was working with, I was in an area of the station, and I looked up and there were about four signs all saying the same thing, and each sign was done by a different aspect of city transit. You know, you had the subway, you had the train service, you had, well, different train services, and so forth. And I remember I saw a guy from one of the other lines, and I asked him, who's in charge here? Who do I look to find out how to coordinate all of this? And he just laughed, and he said, we don't talk to each other. You know, and I think that's kind of a system that I've seen over and over again in not only cities, but institutions and so forth. And if graphics can help pull things together through a visual system or a visual means of just showing that everything can work better, I mean, wow, that's like a dream job. If we can pull that together in Mexico, I'd just love to be part of that. And, you know, I have a stake in it with the Olympics, which is, like you say, it's an image that's kind of hung in there over the years. And my Metro project is still alive and well and functioning very well. You know, this is just great, and I hope it does materialize because I'd love to be part of it.
I want to talk about what might be the dangers, perceived dangers or pitfalls when you brand a city, as it were.
I think it's like anything, you know, I mean, if you're writing, if you're an author, if you're a musician, whatever, if you're lucky and good enough to hit on something that is meaningful and is of not just the moment, but of something that's going to hang around for a while, good for you. And I've been lucky in that respect, I have to say. And, you know, I think it's a two-way street. I remember having a meeting here in New York, and I was talking about how if you respect the public, you'll get respect back. It was during the kind of our graffiti years back in the 70s. And one of the guys, and one I forget who I was working with then, he says, what kind of bullshit is that? And I thought, wow, you know, that's, I just took it for granted because I've done a lot of work out in the street, and it does seem that when you do something in a respectful way, the public respects it. And I think that's right across the line, right down the line, as far as everything that's involved in this type of program. I did show this guy some early things in the office here, which is an old building. It's, well, old here. It's 1880. And there's woodwork that survived being a single-room occupancy building and so forth. And I said, well, look at this. You know New York. You know the history of New York. You know the history of this part of town. And look at these railings, these little spinsters in the railings. I mean, why didn't someone break these? I said, maybe because they're pretty. Maybe because they had intent to be pretty when they were made. And he looked at it and he says, whoa, you got a point. And it is a point. It's not scientific. It's just kind of human nature and kind of, you know, trying to get along with each other in a way where we respect each other, not trying to put things out in the public that can't be destroyed, because that's an invitation to have them destroyed. So there has to be a balance there. I mean, I'm not one way or the other as far as what is going to work, but I think there are a lot of layers of factors that have to be looked at to make things work in a city environment. And certainly one of them is maintenance. I mean, you can do the best stuff, and if your materials aren't great, and if the city doesn't take care of it, it's going to disappear eventually. So, I mean, that's another factor. So good materials, not just good design, but, you know, how and what the design is made from. And then someone taking care of it, you know, it's like everything.
Some cities must be eminently more marketable or brandable, as it were, than others. They might be fortunate enough to be rather attractive places or have a great cultural history. And some places or cities must be more of a challenge. Looking back at your career and your commissions, what sort of cities or places have been particularly challenging?
I think they're all challenging. I think the very nature of each city is very different. They're like individuals. I remember I did Midtown Detroit. Now, I lived in Detroit, and Midtown was one of the areas that was pretty well destroyed in the 60s when they had the riots out there. And a lot of it will probably never build up. But, I mean, God, it's so rich. They have institutions there. They have things that are just very, very rich in that city. And I really loved living there, and I really liked Detroit. It's a real city. I mean, when I say real city, I mean, it's got a vitality about it that kind of ebbs and, you know, goes up and goes down like any city does. And I think they're coming back now. But I think my program was a really interesting experience in that way. It helped clarify that area in town. And I found a richness in what I had to work with there. And I think that's the case in every city. I mean, Mexico City is an absolute gem. I mean, my God, when I went there, I felt, wow, New York's like a baby compared to this city. You know, they go back so far, and they have so many overlapping cultures and so many things that have made that city what it is today. So, I mean, that was a real richness I hadn't experienced before. But I have to say, every city has that to a different degree.
That was legendary graphic designer Lance Wyman in conversation with Monocle's very own David Pleasant. For more on the future of fonts and wayfinding in our cities, you can pick up the latest issue of Monocle magazine for the full scoop. Next on the show, we take time to look at the watch industry right here in London. Last week was the 7th annual installment of Salon QP, the UK's first and only major watch fair. Over 3 days, thousands of visitors from both the trade and the public visited exhibitors from 80 or so watch brands, including Shinola and Montblanc. The festivities unfolded at the Saatchi Gallery in southwest London, and we sent Monocle's watchful reporter Henry Rhys Sheridan along to find out more.
It's a brisk Thursday afternoon here in London, and I'm making my way to the city's pop-up mecca of horology, Salon QP, to talk to some of the brightest minds in the world of timekeeping. I'm going to begin by chatting to Tim Barber, editor of QP magazine, the publication that hosts the event.
There are sort of other more famous exhibitions, Basel World and SIHH, which take place in Switzerland, which are trade shows. They're the ones that some people will have heard of. The difference with this is that it's a public show. It's a public exhibition of watches from around 85 of the world's finest watch brands.
What do you want it to achieve as an event, as a public event?
I think it's about sharing the excitement that we have for the world of fine watches, you know, it's not just something that you wear on your wrist. It becomes a lifestyle for people. People collect watches. There's a whole history of them. There's a cultural side of it. So there's lots of areas for people to get interested in. You know, the hand craftsmanship of so much of these things is mind-boggling.
In terms of commercial success, but also innovation in design and technology, what do you think the big trends in horology have been in the last year, say? And how do you think those trends are going to be reflected in what's on show here?
I think one of the interesting things at the moment is there's a real interest in horological history. There's quite a few new watch brands that have been coming out that we have exhibiting here using old names. So, for instance, Ferdinand Berthoud, who was a great French watchmaker of the 18th century, his name has just been revived in a sensational watch from Chopard, who've launched a new brand in his name. So there's an interest in history, which is really interesting. There's also this very strong interest in design. We have Jaime Hayon, a world-famous product designer. Mark Newson, who's been involved in the design of the Apple Watch and is also obviously one of the most influential designers in the world. Both are exhibiting here. So there's an awful lot of different things, I suppose, that people are interested in.
At Salon QP, as in the world of watches in general, references to motoring abound. Indeed, British sports car manufacturer Lotus was exhibiting two of their newest models at the show. I sat down with Ian Callum, who as design director for Jaguar Cars, oversees that company's enduring collaboration with watchmakers Bremont, to discuss the affinity between watches and wheels.
We were doing a concept car called CX75, and in fact, it's the very same car that's in the Bond film now. The baddie drives it, unfortunately, but that's fine. You know, good to be bad, as we say. But we decided we want a special clock for it, and we looked for someone in Britain who built special watches, and we found Bremont, and we got in touch with them, and that's how our friendship and partnership started. We did a one-off clock for the CX75 concept car.
So many watchmakers find inspiration in motoring and cars, not only the design and engineering, but also the lifestyle. Why do you think this is? Where does this affinity spring from in your mind?
It's an incredible thing, really, but you know, it's a... I dare say it's a bit of a boy's toy thing. I think men who love watches, and it generally tends to be, although we're getting more and more women into very mechanical watches, and men love mechanical cars. And I think it's that mechanical affinity both things have that people find so fascinating. You know, and a car to me is like putting on a suit of clothes. You know, it says so much about you. It says so much about your character. And whether people like it or not, they do wear the car quite consciously or subconsciously about themselves. It's a fact. And watches are the same. You know, it's like men's jewellery, really. A watch is so important to men because it is their jewellery. And it says a lot about themselves.
You've recently released two watches specifically to complement the road-going Jaguar E-Type, launched in 1961. I hope I've got the details right there. Could you describe the design process of these watches for me with specific reference to the ways in which that particular car influenced these particular watches?
Well, the watch that we're talking about, we started off very limited edition of the watch, only six of them, because we built six lightweight E-types at Jaguar to pick up on six chassis numbers we hadn't used. That's another big story, but because we built these six cars, we wanted to build or make six watches to go with them, so the customers had a chance to buy a watch with the car. There's that natural affiliation again. And so what we did was we looked at the graphics of the era, of the time, and we looked at the mechanical dials of the E-type of that time, and there were Smith's dials. They were fairly common design of that period, but we picked on that, and we used the graphics of the Smith's dials of that era to influence the watch. And you can see it right down to the rev counter red line on it, which is very much a car thing. There's no reason to put it on a watch, but that's a nice thing. The relationship goes back to the car. And that's what we did, and we just pulled all the elements of that visually and put them into the watch.
I've heard a lot of people who I've spoken to at Salon QP talk about the narrative element of watches, how watches tell a story as an object. As you mentioned, cars do the same thing. It's another parallel to draw between the two objects. Why is that? You know, do these objects have this effect on you? And if so, what is it that you find in them which is narrativistically engaging?
The thing I find about the narrative of the watches we've just done is that I love the history of that watch. I understand the history of the design, where it's come from. And for me, it's actually nostalgic. I remember those cars when they were brand new. I'm that old, I'm afraid. But it brings back something which to me was very important and quite evocative. And And, you know, it's like smell, the visual thing, it's like smell as well. You just capture that moment in your life that means a lot. So that's what the watches mean to me. It captures that moment. And I think it does for a lot of people too.
And that was Monocle's very own Henry Rees Sheridan reporting from the Salon QP Watch Fair in London, where we'll be returning to in just a few moments. But for now, we have Henry in the studio. Henry, thank you very much for joining us. We just heard there from Tim Barber, the editor of Salon QP magazine. I wonder if you can tell me a little bit more about how this kind of company works. The fair's in its seventh installment, but how does it work? How does the magazine and the kind of fair fit together? And what's the aim of the company?
My understanding is that QP magazine covers the world of high-end watches and horology year-round, but is collaborating with The Telegraph this year. I'm not sure if they've done that in previous years, to host Salon QP, which, as you mentioned in your cue, is the first and only high-end watch fair in England, held in the Saatchi Gallery.
And Henry, you returned to Midori House here in London with a bit of a smile on your face. I gather that it was actually quite an enjoyable assignment. I don't want to give too much away, but quite often the Geneva Watch Fair and other such very interesting design-minded fairs are not always people's favourite assignment, because they can be these kind of large, unassailable kind of exhibitions with people talking about technology that's quite, you know, hard to relate to in the everyday. I wonder, because this was open to the public, whether there was any sort of, whether it was fun, whether there was any sense of pageantry, and whether you enjoyed it.
It certainly was fun. It was full of interesting people. I didn't expect the people there to be so engaging, frankly. I expected them to be watchheads, for want of a better term. I also learned a lot of words. I learned that a chronograph is a watch that contains a stopwatch. I learned that the hands on a watch are referred to as pointers, apparently, by experts, which seems a little bit more juvenile than hands, but there you go. I learned the difference between a quartz watch and a mechanical watch, which I won't bore you with now. But
it's all very interesting to learn this kind of nomenclature, but I wonder what, do you know what the outside face is called?
The outside face of a watch?
Yeah, the bezel. Do you like that?
Well, now I do.
That'll get you through an advertising meeting about watches, knowing what the bezel is.
Much obliged.
And as the next part of your package reveals, I mean, there is a move by some companies to move on the kind of narrative about watches as being a kind of a boy's toy, or a particularly kind of a masculine bent. I mean, what can you tell us about that?
That's right. I mean, you know, Ian Callum, the last person I interviewed, did observe that sometimes horology can seem like a man's world. But one of the best watch companies at Salon QP, and indeed the world, Nomos Glashütte, a German company, is trying to change that, both in the makeup of its workforce, but also by adopting a kind of softer, more cosmopolitan aesthetic. And I sat down with Patricia Helmuth, head of international PR at Nomos, to find out more.
So my name is Patricia Helmuth. I work for Nomos Glashütte, and I'm the head of international PR.
What makes Nomos different from other watch manufacturers?
Our approach to design, and also our approach to watchmaking. Basically, all our calibers are made in-house. We have an in-house production depth of 95%, depending on the caliber. And we have a very unique approach to design. We're a member of the Deutscher Werkbund, which is a predecessor to the Bauhaus movement. Our watches are very restrained in terms of their design, very taken back. It's a good combination of having traditional craftsmanship with a very modern and unique design at a reasonable price point.
Tell me a little bit more about the Deutscher Werkbund.
Well, the Deutscher Werkbund was founded in 1907 by artists, architects, designers, and they actually wanted to produce very good quality products at reasonable prices and with production methods that kind of stood out. And this is something that Nomos is also doing. As I said, we're producing everything in-house. The price is still very affordable. We're aiming for what the Deutscher Werkbund stood for, which was like high-quality pieces at affordable prices and with very good production methods.
Tell me about the most recent work that Nomos has been doing in terms of making watches.
The most recent work really is the Neomatic series. That's a series of 10 new watches. 2x5 watches with either a champagne-colored dial and neon orange accents, or a white silver-plated dial and cyan blue details. And all 10 watches feature our brand new in-house automatic caliber, the DUW 3001. And the very special thing about this movement is that it's only 3.2 millimeters in height. So it's very thin, and we've actually managed to equipped this whole series with the new movement, and we have produced a very nice range of slender and elegant automatic watches that appeal to women and men.
And now for something completely different. My final interviewee is Richard Hoptroff, a physicist turned watchmaker who's invented an atomic mechanism to create unprecedentedly accurate luxury wristwatches. Richard, thanks so much for joining me. Do you want to begin just by introducing yourself and saying what you do?
My name's Richard Hoptroff. I trained as a physicist, and I decided to take these skills and take them into watchmaking.
You specialise in making atomic wristwatches. What is an atomic wristwatch?
An atomic wristwatch is a watch with atomic timekeeping inside it. So instead of a pendulum or a balance spring or quartz, what's inside is a small vessel of cesium, an oven to heat it up to 130 degrees centigrade, a laser to excite the atoms, and then a microwave resonator to extract the resonant frequency of the electrons. That frequency, which is 16 billion billion vibrations an hour, is exceptionally accurate. And when we extract that signal and divide it down to provide the timekeeping, it gives us a timepiece that's accurate to 1 second every 1,000 years.
You say on your website that you have a focus on high accuracy, as we've discussed, and innovative complications. Could you explain to me what a complication is and which complications you like to include in your watches and how?
The idea of a complication in a watch is really the watchmaker showing off, because it's his opportunity to display something that's very difficult to achieve. There's a long tradition of this in mechanical watchmaking. We decided to continue it in our electromechanical watches, but of course we can achieve so much more. And the secret is not that you can do it, but what you choose to do. We call them complications just because of the history of watchmaking. But in fact, what we do is very simple but innovative ideas, such as the watch that I personally wear has an anniversary reminder. It's counting down the number of days till the end of Salon QP at the moment. So you can see there are 2 days to go. So that's a nice simple complication, but the important thing about it is it emphasizes that what we're trying to achieve when we do something like this is personalize it to you. So this has all my birthdays in it, our wedding anniversary and so on, so I don't forget them.
What's next for you in terms of the really big leap forward that you're aiming for as a person of your sensibilities and abilities?
Well, we're actually able to innovate very quickly, so I can't really see much further than 3 months ahead. For example, the number one atomic watch, which is about the size of a diver's watch, is a clear progression to smaller and smaller atomic watches. For the moment, we've probably reached the limit of how far we can go, but there are other areas we want to do to bring new functionality to customers. Particularly, we're interested in tide heights, because we know we can deliver exact tide heights, which again is all to do with personalizing watches for individual people and using technology to make them more personal to you.
That was Monocle's very own Henry Rees Sheridan reporting from the 7th annual installment of the Salon QP Watch Fair, which took place right here in London last week. And sadly, that's all we have time for on this week's programme. Today's show was sprucely produced by Ben Ryland, reliably researched by Henry Rees Sheridan, and elegantly edited by Alex Funnell. If you have any comments, queries, or suggestions, you can drop our researcher Henry a note at hrs@monocle.com. And of course, you can always listen again or brush up on our back catalogue at monocle.com or subscribe via SoundCloud or iTunes. You've been listening to Section D. I'm Josh Fennett, and until next time, goodbye.